Interest means stake, as in conflict of interest and financial interest. Adding ed to a noun can make it pertain to someone that owns the referent of that noun, as in moneyed, one-eyed, or hook-nosed. Dis negates the combination. The grammatical logic reveals itself in the similarly structured disadvantaged, disaffected, disillusioned, disjointed, and dispossessed. Since we already have the word uninterested, there can be no reason to rob discerning language lovers of disinterested by merging their meanings, except as a tacky attempt to sound more highfalutin. And don't get me started on fortuitous and parameter. Chill out, Professor. The original 18th century meaning of disinterested turns out to be, yes, uninterested. And that, too, makes grammatical sense. The adjective interested, meaning engaged, related to the participle of the verb to interest, is far more common than the noun interest, meaning stake. So dis can be analyzed as simply negating that adjective, as in discourteous, dishonest, disloyal, disreputable, and the parallel dissatisfied and distrusted. But these rationalizations are beside the point. Every component of a language changes over time, and at any moment a language is enduring many losses. But since the human mind does not change over time, the richness of a language is always being replenished. Whenever any of us gets grumpy about some change in usage, we would do well to read the words of Samuel Johnson in the preface to his 1755 Dictionary, a reaction to the Jeremiahs of his day. Those who have been persuaded to think well of my design require that it should fix our language and put a stop to those alterations which time and chance have hitherto been suffered to make in it without opposition. With this consequence, I will confess that I have flattered myself for a while, but now begin to fear that I have indulged expectations which neither reason nor experience can justify. When we see men grow old and die at a certain time, one after another, from century to century, we laugh at the elixir that promises to prolong life to 1,000 years, and with equal justice may the lexicographer be derided, who, being able to produce no example of a nation that has preserved their words and phrases from mutability, shall imagine that his dictionary can embalm his language and secure it from corruption and decay, that it is in his power to change sublunary nature and clear the world at once from folly, vanity, and affectation. With this hope, however, academies have been instituted to guard the avenues of their languages, to retain fugitives and to repulse intruders. But their vigilance and activity have hitherto been vain. Sounds are too volatile and subtle for legal restraints. To enchain syllables and to lash the wind are equally the undertakings of pride, unwilling to measure its desires by its strength. Chapter 13. Mind Design. Early in this book, I asked you why you should believe that there is a language instinct. Now that I have done my best to convince you that there is one, it is time to ask you why you should care. Having a language, of course, is part of what it means to be human, so it is natural to be curious. But having hands that are not occupied in locomotion is even more important to being human, and chances are you would never have made it to the last chapter of a book about the human hand. People are more than curious about language. They are passionate. The reason is obvious. Language is the most accessible part of the mind. People want to know about language because they hope this knowledge will lead to insight about human nature. This tie-in animates linguistic research, raising the stakes in arcane technical disagreements and attracting the attention of scholars from far-flung disciplines. Jerry Fodor, the philosopher and experimental psycholinguist, studies whether sentence parsing is an encapsulated mental module or blends in with general intelligence, and he is more honest than most in discussing his interest in the controversy. But look, you might ask, why do you care about modules so much? You've got tenure. Why don't you take off and go sailing? This is a perfectly reasonable question and one that I often ask myself. Roughly, the idea that cognition saturates perception belongs with, and is indeed historically connected with, the idea in the philosophy of science that one's observations are comprehensively determined by one's theories, with the idea in anthropology that one's values are comprehensively determined by one's culture, with the idea in sociology that one's epistemic commitments, including especially one's science, are comprehensively determined by one's class affiliations, and with the idea in linguistics that one's metaphysics is comprehensively determined by one's syntax, i.e., the Whorfian hypothesis. All these ideas imply a kind of relativistic holism, because perception is saturated by cognition, observation by theory, values by culture, science by class, and metaphysics by language, rational criticism of scientific theories, ethical values, metaphysical worldviews, or whatever can take place only within the framework of assumptions that, as a matter of geographical, historical, or sociological accident, the interlocutors happen to share. What you can't do is rationally criticize the framework. The thing is, I hate relativism. I hate relativism more than I hate anything else, excepting maybe fiberglass powerboats. More to the point, I think that relativism is very probably false. What it overlooks, to put it briefly and crudely, is the fixed structure of human nature. That is not, of course, a novel insight. On the contrary, the malleability of human nature is a doctrine that relativists are invariably much inclined to stress. See, for example, John Dewey. Well, in cognitive psychology, the claim that there is a fixed structure of human nature traditionally takes the form of an insistence on the heterogeneity of cognitive mechanisms and the rigidity of the cognitive architecture that affects their encapsulation. If there are faculties and modules, then not everything affects everything else. Not everything is plastic. Whatever the all is, at least there is more than one of it. For Fodor, a sentence perception module that delivers the speaker's message verbatim, undistorted by the listener's biases and expectations, is emblematic of a universally structured human mind, the same in all places and times, that would allow people to agree on what is just and true as a matter of objective reality rather than of taste, custom, and self-interest. It is a bit of a stretch, but no one can deny that there is a connection. Modern intellectual life is suffused with a relativism that denies that there is such a thing as a universal human nature, and the existence of a language instinct in any form challenges that denial. The doctrine underlying that relativism, the standard social science model, SSSM, began to dominate intellectual life in the 1920s. It was a fusion of an idea from anthropology and an idea from psychology. One, whereas animals are rigidly controlled by their biology, human behavior is determined by culture, an autonomous system of symbols and values. Free from biological constraints, cultures can vary from one another arbitrarily and without limit. Two, human infants are born with nothing more than a few reflexes and an ability to learn. Learning is a general-purpose process used in all domains of knowledge. Children learn their culture through indoctrination, reward and punishment, and role models. The SSSM has not only been the foundation of the study of humankind within the academy, but serves as the secular ideology of our age, the position on human nature that any decent person should hold. The alternative, sometimes called biological determinism, is said to assign people to fixed slots in the socio-political economic hierarchy and to be the cause of many of the horrors of recent centuries: slavery, colonialism, racial and ethnic discrimination, economic and social castes, forced sterilization, sexism, genocide. Two of the most famous founders of the SSSM, the anthropologist Margaret Mead and the psychologist John Watson, clearly had these social implications in mind. we are forced to conclude that human nature is almost unbelievably malleable, responding accurately and contrastingly to contrasting cultural conditions. The members of either or both sexes may, with more or less success in the case of different individuals, be educated to approximate any temperament. If we are to achieve a richer culture, rich in contrasting values, we must recognize the whole gamut of human potentialities and so weave a less arbitrary social fabric, one in which each diverse human gift will find a fitting place. Mead, 1935. Give me a dozen healthy infants, well-formed, and my own specified world to bring them up in, and I'll guarantee to take any one at random and train him to become any type of specialist I might select. Doctor, lawyer, artist, merchant chief, and yes, even beggarman and thief, regardless of his talents, penchants, tendencies, abilities, vocations, and race of his ancestors. Watson, 1925. At least in the rhetoric of the educated, the SSSM has attained total victory. In polite intellectual conversations and respectable journalism, any generalization about human behavior is carefully prefaced with SSSM shibboleths that distance the speaker from history's distasteful hereditarians, from medieval kings to Archie Bunker. Our society, the discussions begin, even if no other society has been examined, socializes us, they continue, even if the experiences of the child are never considered. To the role, they conclude, regardless of the aptness of the metaphor of role, a character or part arbitrarily assigned to be played by a performer. Very recently, the news magazines tell us that the pendulum is swinging back. As they describe the appalled pacifist feminist parents of a 3-year-old gun nut son and a 4-year-old Barbie doll obsessed daughter, they remind the reader that hereditary factors cannot be ignored, and that all behavior is an interaction between nature and nurture, whose contributions are as inseparable as the length and width of a rectangle in determining its area. I would be depressed if what we have learned about the language instinct were folded into the mindless dichotomies of heredity-environment, a.k.a. nature-nurture, nativism-empiricism, innate-acquired biology-culture, the unhelpful bromides about inextricably intertwined interactions, or the cynical image of a swaying pendulum of scientific fashion. I think that our understanding of language offers a more satisfying way of studying the human mind and human nature. To begin with, we can discard the pre-scientific magical model in which the issues are usually framed, heredity causes behavior, or environment causes behavior. The controversy over whether heredity, environment, or some interaction between the two causes behavior is just incoherent. The organism has vanished. There is an environment without someone to perceive it, behavior without a behavior, learning without a learner. As Alice thought to herself when the Cheshire Cat vanished quite slowly, ending with a grin, which remained some time after the rest of it had gone, "Well, I've often seen a cat without a grin, but a grin without a cat, it's the most curious thing I ever saw in all my life." The following model is also simplistic, but it is a much better beginning. Environment provides input to innate psychological mechanisms, including learned mechanisms. Heredity builds innate psychological mechanisms, including learning mechanisms. Skills, knowledge, values, develops and accesses innate psychological mechanisms, including learning mechanisms, and vice versa. Behavior is caused by innate psychological mechanisms, including learning mechanisms. For we can now do justice to the complexity of the human brain, the immediate cause of all perception, learning, and behavior. Learning is not an alternative to innateness. Without an innate mechanism to do the learning, it would not happen at all. The insights we have gained about the language instinct make this clear. First, to reassure the nervous, Yes, there are important roles for both heredity and environment. A child brought up in Japan ends up speaking Japanese. The same child, if brought up in the United States, would end up speaking English. So we know that the environment plays a role. If a child is inseparable from a pet hamster when growing up, the child ends up speaking a language, but the hamster, exposed to the same environment, does not. So we know that heredity plays a role. But there is much more to say. Since people can understand and speak an infinite number of novel sentences, it makes no sense to try to characterize their behavior directly. No two people's language behavior is the same, and a person's potential behavior cannot even be listed. But an infinite number of sentences can be generated by a finite rule system, a grammar, and it does make sense to study the mental grammar and other psychological mechanisms underlying language behavior. Language comes so naturally to us that we tend to be blasé about it, like urban children who think that milk just comes from a truck. But a close-up examination of what it takes to put words together into ordinary sentences reveals that mental language mechanisms must have a complex design, with many interacting parts. Under this microscope, the babel of languages no longer appear to vary in arbitrary ways and without limit. One now sees a common design to the machinery underlying the world's language, a universal grammar. Unless this basic design is built into the mechanism that learns a particular grammar, learning would be impossible. There are many possible ways of generalizing from parents' speech to the language as a whole, and children home in on the right ones fast. Finally, some of the learning mechanisms appear to be designed for language itself, not for culture and symbolic behavior in general. We have seen Stone Age people with high-tech grammars, helpless toddlers who are competent grammarians, and linguistic idiot savants. We have seen a logic of grammar that cuts across the logic of common sense. The it of it is raining that behaves like the John of John is running. The mice-eaters who eat mice differing from the rat-eaters who eat rats. The lessons of language have not been lost on the sciences of the rest of the mind. An alternative to the standard social science model has emerged, with roots in Darwin and William James, and with inspiration from the research on language by Chomsky and the psychologists and linguists in his wake. It has been applied to visual perception by the computational neuroscientist David Marr and the psychologist Roger Shepard, and has been elaborated by the anthropologists Dan Sperber, Donald Simons, and John Tooby, the linguist Ray Jackendoff, the neuroscientist Michael Gazzaniga, and the psychologists Lida Cosmides, Randy Galistel, Frank Keel, and Paul Rosen. Tooby and Cosmides, in their important recent essay, The Psychological Foundations of Culture, call it the integrated causal model, because it seeks to explain how evolution caused the emergence of a brain, which causes psychological processes like knowing and learning, which cause the acquisition of the values and knowledge that make up a person's culture. It thus integrates psychology and anthropology into the rest of the natural sciences, especially neuroscience and evolutionary biology. Because of this last connection, they also call it evolutionary psychology. Evolutionary psychology takes many of the lessons of human language and applies them to the rest of the psyche. Just as language is an improbable feat requiring intricate mental software, the other accomplishments of mental life that we take for granted, like perceiving, reasoning, and acting, require their own well-engineered mental software. Just as there is a universal design to the computations of grammar, there is a universal design to the rest of the human mind, an assumption that is not just a hopeful wish for human unity and brotherhood, but an actual discovery about the human species that is well motivated by evolutionary biology and genetics. Evolutionary psychology does not disrespect learning, but seeks to explain it. In Molière's play, Le Malade Imaginaire, the learned doctor is asked to explain how opium puts people to sleep, and cites its sleep-producing power. Leibniz similarly ridiculed thinkers who invoke expressly occult qualities or faculties which they imagine to be like little demons or goblins capable of producing unceremoniously that which is demanded, just as if watches marked the hours by a certain horodictic faculty without having need of wheels, or as if mills crushed grains by a fractive faculty without needing anything resembling millstones. In the standard social science model, learning has been invoked in just these ways. In evolutionary psychology, there is no learning without some innate mechanism that makes the learning happen. Learning mechanisms for different spheres of human experience, language, morals, food, social relations, the physical world, and so on, are often found to work at cross-purposes. A mechanism designed to learn the right thing in one of these domains learns exactly the wrong thing in the others. This suggests that learning is accomplished not by some single general-purpose device, but by different modules, each keyed to the peculiar logic and laws of one domain. People are flexible, not because the environment pounds or sculpts their minds into arbitrary shapes, but because their minds contain so many different modules, each with provisions to learn in its own way. Since biological systems with signs of complex engineering are unlikely to have arisen from accidents or coincidences, their organization must come from natural selection, and hence should have functions useful for survival and reproduction in the environments in which humans evolved. This does not mean, however, that all aspects of mind are adaptations, or that the mind's adaptations are necessarily beneficial in evolutionary novel environments like 20th century cities. Finally, culture is given its due, but not as some disembodied ghostly process or fundamental force of nature. Culture refers to the process whereby particular kinds of learning contagiously spread from person to person in a community, and minds become coordinated into shared patterns, just as a language or a dialect refers to the process whereby the different speakers in a community acquire highly similar mental grammars. A good place to begin discussing this new view of mind design is the place we began in discussing the language instinct, universality. Language, I noted early on, is universal among human societies, and as far as we know, has been throughout the history of our species. Though languages are mutually unintelligible, beneath this superficial variation lies the single computational design of universal grammar, with its nouns and verbs, phrase structures and word structures, cases and auxiliaries, and so on. At first glance, the ethnographic record seems to offer a stark contrast. Anthropology in this century has taken us through a mind-broadening fairground of human diversity. But might this carnival of taboos, kinship systems, shamanry, and all the rest be as superficial as the difference between dog and hund, hiding a universal human nature? The culture of anthropologists themselves makes one apprehensive about their leitmotif that anything goes. One of America's most prominent, Clifford Geertz, has exhorted his colleagues to be merchants of astonishment who hawk the anomalous, peddle the strange. If we wanted only home truths, he adds, we should have stayed at home. But this is an attitude that guarantees that anthropologists will miss any universal pattern in human ways. In fact, it can lead to outright error, as the commonplace is cloaked as the anomalous, as in the great Eskimo vocabulary hoax. As one young anthropologist wrote to me, "The Eskimo vocabulary story will get its own section in a project of mine, a book whose working title is 100 Years of Anthropological Malpractice. I have been collecting instances of gross professional incompetence for years now, all of the anthropological chestnuts that turn out not to be true, but maintain their presence in textbooks anyway as the intellectual commonplaces of the field. Samoan free sex and the resultant lack of crime and frustration. The sex-reversed cultures like the gentle Arapesh, the men are headhunters, the Stone Age pristine Tassaday, a fabrication of the corrupt Philippine Minister of Culture, nearby villagers dressed down as matriarchal primitives, the ancient matriarchies during the dawn of civilization, the fundamentally different Hopi concept of time, the cultures that everyone knows are out there where everything is the reverse of here, etc., etc. One of the unifying threads will be that complete cultural relativism makes anthropologists far more credulous of almost any absurdity. Castaneda's Don Juan novels, which I really enjoyed, by the way, are in many textbooks as sober fact, than almost any ordinary person would be, equipped only with common sense. In other words, their professional expertise has made them complete and total gulls. Just as fundamentalism disposes you to accept accounts of miracles, being of the trained anthropologist faith disposes you to believe in any exotic account from elsewhere. In fact, a lot of this nonsense is part of the standard intellectual equipment of every educated social scientist, providing a permanent obstacle to balanced reasoning about various psychological and social phenomena. I figure it will make me permanently unemployable, so I am not aiming to finish it any time soon. The allusion to Samoan free sex pertains to Derek Freeman's 1983 bombshell showing how Margaret Mead got the facts wrong in her classic book, Coming of Age in Samoa. Among other things, her bored teenage informants enjoyed pulling her leg. The other accusations are carefully documented in a recent review, Human Universals, written by another anthropologist, Donald E. Brown, who was trained in the standard ethnographic tradition. Brown has noted that behind anthropologists' accounts of the strange behavior of foreign peoples, there are clear but abstract universals of human experience such as rank, politeness, and humor. Indeed, anthropologists could not understand or live within other human groups unless they shared a rich set of common assumptions with them, what Dan Sperber calls a metaculture. Tooby and Cosmides wrote, "Like fish unaware of the existence of water, anthropologists swim from culture to culture, interpreting through universal human metaculture. Metaculture informs their every thought, but they have not yet noticed its existence. When anthropologists go to other cultures, the experience of variation awakens them to things they had previously taken for granted in their own culture. Similarly, biologists and artificial intelligence researchers are anthropologists who travel to places where minds are far stranger than anywhere any ethnographer has ever gone." Inspired by Chomsky's Universal Grammar, UG, Brown has tried to characterize the universal people, UP. He has scrutinized archives of ethnography for universal patterns underlying the behavior of all documented human cultures, keeping a skeptical eye out both for claims of the exotic, belied by the ethnographer's own reports, and for claims of the universal based on flimsy evidence. The outcome is stunning. Far from finding arbitrary variation, Brown was able to characterize the universal people in gloriously rich detail. His findings contain something to startle almost anyone, and so I will reproduce the substance of them here. According to Brown, the universal people have the following: value placed on articulateness, gossip, lying, misleading, verbal humor, humorous insults, poetic and rhetorical speech forms, narrative and storytelling, metaphor, poetry with repetition of linguistic elements and 3-second lines separated by pauses, words for days, months, seasons, years, past, present, future, body parts, inner states, emotions, sensations, thoughts, behavioral propensities, flora, fauna, weather, tools, space, motion, speed, location, spatial dimensions, physical properties, giving, lending, affecting things and people, numbers, at the very least 1, 2, and more than 2, proper names, possession, distinctions between mother and father, kinship categories defined in terms of mother, father, son, daughter, and age sequence, binary distinctions including male and female, black and white, natural and cultural, good and bad, measures, logical relations including not, and, same, equivalent, opposite, general versus particular, part versus whole, conjectural reasoning, inferring the presence of absent and invisible entities from their perceptible traces. Non-linguistic vocal communication such as cries and squeals, interpreting intention from behavior, recognized facial expressions of happiness, sadness, anger, fear, surprise, disgust, and contempt, use of smiles as a friendly greeting, crying, coy flirtation with the eyes, masking, modifying, and mimicking facial expressions, displays of affection, sense of self versus other, responsibility, voluntary versus involuntary behavior, intention, private inner life, normal versus abnormal mental states, empathy, sexual attraction, powerful sexual jealousy, childhood fears, especially of loud noises, and, at the end of the first year, strangers, fear of snakes, Oedipal feelings, possessiveness of mother, coolness toward her consort, face recognition, adornment of bodies and arrangement of hair, sexual attractiveness, based in part on signs of health and, in women, youth, hygiene, dance, music, play, including play fighting, manufacture of and dependence upon many kinds of tools, many of them permanent, made according to culturally transmitted motifs, including cutters, pounders, containers, string, levers, spears, use of fire to cook food and for other purposes, drugs, both medicinal and recreational, shelter, decoration of artifacts, a standard pattern and time for weaning, living in groups which claim a territory and have a sense of being a distinct people, families built around a mother and children, usually the biological mother and one or more men, institutionalized marriage in the sense of publicly recognized right of sexual access to a woman eligible for childbearing, socialization of children, including toilet training, by senior kin, children copying their elders, distinguishing of close kin from distant kin and favoring of close kin, avoidance of incest between mothers and sons, great interest in the topic of sex, status and prestige, both assigned by kinship, age, sex, and achieved, some degree of economic inequality, division of labor by sex and age, more child care by women, more aggression and violence by men, acknowledgement of differences between male and female natures, domination by men in the public political sphere, exchange of labor, goods, and services, reciprocity, including retaliation, gifts, social reasoning, coalitions, government in the sense of binding collective decisions about public affairs, leaders almost always non-dictatorial, perhaps ephemeral, laws, rights, and obligations, including laws against violence, rape, and murder, punishment, conflict which is deplored, rape, seeking of redress for wrongs, mediation, in-group, out-group conflicts, property, inheritance of property, sense of right and wrong, envy, etiquette, hospitality, feasting, diurnality, standards of sexual modesty, sex generally in private, fondness for sweets, food taboos, discreetness in elimination of body wastes, supernatural beliefs, magic to sustain and increase life and to attract the opposite sex, theories of fortune and misfortune, explanations of disease and death, medicine, rituals, including rites of passage, mourning the dead, dreaming, interpreting dreams. Obviously, this is not a list of instincts or innate psychological propensities. It is a list of complex interactions between a universal human nature and the conditions of living in a human body on this planet. Nor, I hasten to add, is it a characterization of the inevitable, a demarcation of the possible, or a prescription of the desirable. A list of human universals a century ago could have included the absence of ice cream, oral contraceptives, movies, rock and roll, women's suffrage, and books about the language instinct, but that would not have stood in the way of these innovations. Like the identical twins reared apart who dipped buttered toast in their coffee, Brown's universal people jolts our preconceptions about human nature. And just as the discoveries about twins do not call for a buttered toast and coffee gene, the discoveries about universals do not implicate a universal toilet training instinct. A theory of the universal mind is doubtless going to be as abstractly related to the universal people as X-bar theory is related to a list of universals of word order. But it seems certain that any such theory will have to put more in the human head than a generalized tendency to learn or to copy an arbitrary role model. With the assumption of an infinitely variable human nature from anthropology out of the way, let's look at the assumption of an infinitely acquisitive learning ability from psychology. How might we make sense of the concept of a general, multipurpose learning device? Explicit pedagogy, learning by being told, is one kind of general-purpose learning, but most would agree it is the least important. Few people have been convinced by arguments like, "No one ever teaches children how universal grammar works, but they respect it anyway. Therefore, it must be innate." Most learning, everyone agrees, takes place outside of classroom lessons, by generalizing from examples. Children generalize from role models or from their own behaviors that are rewarded or not rewarded. The power comes from the generalization according to similarity. A child who echoed back a parent's sentences verbatim would be called autistic, not a powerful learner. Children generalize to sentences that are similar to their parents, not to those sentences exactly. Likewise, a child who observes that barking German shepherds bite should generalize to barking Doberman pinschers and other similar dogs. Similarity is thus the mainspring of a hypothetical general multipurpose learning device, and there is the rub. In the words of the logician Nelson Goodman, similarity is a pretender, an imposter, a quack. The problem is that similarity is in the mind of the beholder, just what we are trying to explain, not in the world. Goodman writes, "Consider baggage at an airport check-in station. The spectator may notice shape, size, color, material, and even make of luggage. The pilot is more concerned with weight, and the passenger with destination and ownership. Which pieces of baggage are more alike than others depends not only upon what properties they share, but upon who makes the comparison and when. Or suppose we have three glasses, the first two filled with colorless liquid, the third with a bright red liquid. I might be likely to say the first two are more like each other than either is like the third, but it happens that the first glass is filled with water, and the third with water colored by a drop of vegetable dye, while the second is filled with hydrochloric acid. And I am thirsty." The unavoidable implication is that a sense of similarity must be innate. This much is not controversial. It is simple logic. In behaviorist psychology, when a pigeon is rewarded for pecking a key in the presence of a red circle, it pecks more to a red ellipse or to a pink circle than it does to a blue square. This stimulus generalization happens automatically, without extra training, and it entails an innate similarity space. Otherwise, the animal would generalize to everything or to nothing. These subjective spacings of stimuli are necessary for learning, so they cannot all be learned themselves. Thus, even the behaviorist is cheerfully up to his neck in innate similarity-determining mechanisms, as the logician W.V. O'Quine pointed out, and his colleague B.F. Skinner did not demur. For language acquisition, what is the innate similarity space that allows children to generalize from sentences in their parents' speech to the similar sentences that define the rest of English? Obviously, red is more similar to pink than to blue, or circle is more similar to ellipse than to triangle, is of no help. It must be some kind of mental computation that makes John likes fish similar to Mary eats apples, but not similar to John Might fish. Otherwise, the child would say, John Might apples. It must make the dog seems sleepy similar to the men seem happy, but not similar to the dog seems sleeping, so that the child will avoid that false sleep. That is, the similarity guiding the child's generalization has to be an analysis of speech into nouns and verbs and phrases, computed by the universal grammar built into the learning mechanisms. Without such innate computation defining which sentence is similar to which other ones, the child would have no way of correctly generalizing. Any sentence is similar, in one sense, to nothing but a verbatim repetition of itself, and also similar, in another sense, to any random rearrangement of those words, and similar in still other senses to all kinds of other inappropriate word strings. This is why it is no paradox to say that flexibility in learned behavior require innate constraints on the mind. The chapter on language acquisition offers a good example. The ability of children to generalize to an infinite number of potential sentences depends on their analyzing parental speech using a fixed set of mental categories. So learning a grammar from examples requires a special similarity space, defined by universal grammar. So does learning the meanings of words from examples, as we saw in Quine's Gavagai problem, in which a word learner has no logical basis for knowing whether Gavagai means rabbit, hopping rabbit, or undetached rabbit parts. What does this say about learning everything else? Here is how Quine reports and diffuses what he calls the scandal of induction. It makes one wonder the more about other inductions, where what is sought is a generalization not about our neighbor's verbal behavior, but about the harsh impersonal world. It is reasonable that our mental quality space should match our neighbor's, we being birds of a feather. And so the general trustworthiness of induction in the learning of words was a put-up job. To trust induction as a way of access to the truths of nature, on the other hand, is to suppose more nearly that our quality space matches that of the cosmos. But why does our innate subjective spacing of qualities accord so well with the functionally relevant groupings in nature as to make our inductions tend to come out right? Why should our subjective spacing of qualities have a special purchase on nature and a lien on the future? There is some encouragement in Darwin. If people's innate spacing of qualities is a gene-linked trait, then the spacing that is made for the most successful inductions will have tended to predominate through natural selection. Creatures inveterately wrong in their inductions have a pathetic but praiseworthy tendency to die before reproducing their kind. Quite right. Though the cosmos is heterogeneous, and thus the computations of similarity that allow our generalizations to harmonize with it must be heterogeneous too. Qualities that make two utterances equivalent in terms of learning the grammar, such as being composed of the same sequence of nouns and verbs, should not make them equivalent in terms of scaring away animals, such as being a certain loudness. Qualities that should make bits of vegetation equivalent in terms of causing or curing an illness, such as being different parts of a kind of plant, are not the qualities that should make them equivalent for nutrition, like sweetness. Equivalent for feeding a fire like dryness, equivalent for insulating a shelter like bulk, or equivalent for giving as a gift like beauty. The qualities that should classify people as potential allies, such as showing signs of affection, should not necessarily classify them as potential mates, such as showing signs of fertility and not being close blood relatives. There must be many similarity spaces, defined by different instincts or modules, allowing those modules to generalize intelligently in some domain of knowledge, such as the physical world, the biological world, or the social world. Since innate similarity spaces are inherent to the logic of learning, it is not surprising that human-engineered learning systems in artificial intelligence are always innately designed to exploit the constraints in some domain of knowledge. A computer program intended to learn the rules of baseball is pre-programmed with the assumptions underlying competitive sports so that it will not interpret players' motions as a choreographed dance or a religious ritual. A program designed to learn the past tense of English verbs is given only the verb's sound as its input. A program designed to learn a verb's dictionary entry is given only its meaning. This requirement is apparent in what the designers do, though not always in what they say. Working within the assumptions of the standard social science model, the computer scientists often hype their programs as mere demos of powerful general-purpose learning systems. But because no one would be so foolhardy as to try to model the entire human mind, the researchers can take advantage of this allegedly practical limitation. They are free to hand-tailor their demo program to the kind of problem it is charged with solving, and they can be a deus ex machina, funneling just the right inputs to the program at just the right time. Which is not a criticism. That's the way learning systems have to work. So what are the modules of the human mind? A common academic parody of Chomsky has him proposing innate modules for bicycling, matching ties with shirts, rebuilding carburetors, and so on. But the slope from language to carburetor repair is not that slippery. We can avoid this skid with some obvious footholds. Using engineering analyses, we can examine what a system would need, in principle, to do the right kind of generalizing for the problem it is solving. For example, in studying how humans perceive shapes, we can ask whether a system that learns to recognize different kinds of furniture can also recognize different faces, or whether it needs special shape analyzers for faces. Using biological anthropology, we can look for evidence that a problem is one that our ancestors had to solve in the environments in which they evolved. So language and face recognition are at least candidates for innate modules, but reading and driving are not. Using data from psychology and ethnography, we can test the following prediction. When children solve problems for which they have mental modules, they should look like geniuses, knowing things they have not been taught. When they solve problems that their minds are not equipped for, it should be a long, hard slog. Finally, if a module for some problem is real, neuroscience should discover that the brain tissue computing the problem has some kind of physiological cohesiveness, such as constituting a circuit or subsystem. Being a bit foolhardy myself, I will venture a guess as to what kinds of modules or families of instincts might eventually pass these tests, aside from language and perception. For justification, I refer you to a recent compendium called The Adapted Mind. 1. Intuitive mechanics, knowledge of the motions, forces, and deformations that objects undergo. 2. Intuitive biology, understanding of how plants and animals work. 3. Number. 4. Mental maps for large territories. 5. Habitat selection, seeking of safe, information-rich, productive environments, generally savanna-like. 6. Danger, including the emotions of fear and caution, phobias for stimuli such as heights, confinement, risky social encounters, and venomous and predatory animals, and a motive to learn the circumstances in which each is harmless. 7. Food, what is good to eat. 8. Contamination, including the emotion of disgust, reactions to certain things that seem inherently disgusting, and intuitions about contagion and disease. 9. Monitoring of current well-being, including the emotions of happiness and sadness, and moods of contentment and restlessness. 10. Intuitive psychology, predicting other people's behavior from their beliefs and desires. 11. A mental Rolodex, a database of individuals with blanks for kinship, status, or rank, history of exchange of favors, and inherent skills and strengths, plus criteria that evaluate each trait. 12. Self-concept, gathering and organizing information about one's value to other people and packaging it for others. 13. Justice, sense of rights, obligations, and deserts, including the emotions of anger and revenge. 14. Kinship, including nepotism and allocations of parenting effort. 15. Mating, including feelings of sexual attraction, love, and intentions of fidelity and desertion. To see how far standard psychology is from this conception, just turn to the table of contents of any textbook. The chapters will be physiological, learning, memory, attention, thinking, decision-making, intelligence, motivation, emotion, social, development, personality, abnormal. I believe that with the exception of perception, and of course language, not a single curriculum unit in psychology corresponds to a cohesive chunk of the mind. Perhaps this explains the syllabus shock experienced by introductory psychology students. It is like explaining how a car works by first discussing the steel parts, then the aluminum parts, then the red parts, and so on, instead of the electrical system, the transmission, the fuel system, and so on. Interestingly, textbooks on the brain are more likely to be organized around what I think of as real modules: mental maps, fear, rage, feeding, maternal behavior, language, and sex are all common sections in neuroscience texts. For some readers, the preceding list will be the final proof that I have lost my mind. An innate module for doing biology? Biology is a recently invented academic discipline. Students struggle through it. The person in the street and tribes around the world are founts of superstition and misinformation. The idea seems only slightly less mad than the innate carburetor repair instinct. But recent evidence suggests otherwise. There may be an innate folk biology that gives people different basic intuitions about plants and animals than they have about other objects, like man-made artifacts. The study of folk biology is young compared with the study of language, and the idea might be wrong. Maybe we reason about living things using two modules, one for plants and one for animals. Maybe we use a bigger module, one that embraces other natural kinds, like rocks and mountains. Or maybe we use an inappropriate module, like folk psychology. But the evidence so far is suggestive enough that I can present folk biology as an example of a possible cognitive module other than language, giving you an idea of the kinds of things an instinct-populated mind might contain. To begin with, as hard as it may be for a supermarket-jaded city dweller to believe, Stone Age hunter-gatherers are erudite botanists and zoologists. They typically have names for hundreds of wild plant and animal species, and copious knowledge of those species' life cycles, ecology, and behavior, allowing them to make subtle and sophisticated inferences. They might observe the shape, freshness, and direction of an animal's tracks, the time of day and year, and the details of the local terrain to predict what kind of animal it is, where it has gone, and how old, hungry, tired, and scared it is likely to be. A flowering plant in the spring might be remembered through the summer and returned to in the fall for its underground tuber. The use of medicinal drugs, recall, is part of the lifestyle of the universal people. What kind of psychology underlies this talent? How does our mental similarity space accord with this part of the cosmos? Plants and animals are special kinds of objects. For a mind to reason intelligently about them, it should treat them differently from rocks, islands, clouds, tools, machines, and money, among other things. Here are four of the basic differences. First, organisms, at least sexual organisms, belong to populations of interbreeding individuals adapted to an ecological niche. This makes them fall into species with a relatively unified structure and behavior. For example, all robins are more or less alike, but they are different from sparrows. Second, related species descended from a common ancestor by splitting off from a lineage. This makes them fall into non-overlapping, hierarchically included classes. For example, sparrows and robins are alike in being birds. Birds and mammals are alike in being vertebrates. Vertebrates and insects are alike in being animals. Third, because an organism is a complex, self-preserving system, It is governed by dynamic physiological processes that are lawful even when hidden. For example, the biochemical organization of an organism enables it to grow and move and is lost when it dies. Fourth, because organisms have separate genotypes and phenotypes, they have a hidden essence that is conserved as they grow, change form, and reproduce. For example, a caterpillar, chrysalis, and butterfly are in a crucial sense the same animal. Remarkably, people's unschooled intuition about living things seems to mesh with these core biological facts, including the intuitions of young children who cannot read and have not set foot in a biology lab. The anthropologists Brent Berlin and Scott Atran have studied folk taxonomies of flora and fauna. They have found that, universally, people group local plants and animals into kinds that correspond to the genus level in the Linnaean classification system of professional biology. Species, genus, family, order, class, phylum, kingdom. Since most locales contain a single species from any genus, these folk categories usually correspond to species as well. People also classify kinds into higher-level life forms, like tree, grass, moss, quadruped, bird, fish, and insect. Most of the life form categories of animals coincide with the biologist's level of class. Folk classifications, like professional biologists' classifications, are strictly hierarchical. Every plant or animal belongs to one and only one genus. Every genus belongs to only one life form. Every life form is either a plant or an animal. Plants and animals are living things, and every object is either a living thing or not. All this gives people's intuitive biological concepts a logical structure that is different from the one that organizes their other concepts, such as human-made artifacts. Whereas people everywhere say that an animal cannot be both fish and fowl, they are perfectly happy with saying, for example, that a wheelchair can be both furniture and vehicle, or that a piano can be both musical instrument and furniture. And this in turn makes reasoning about natural kinds different from reasoning about artifacts. People can deduce that if a trout is a kind of fish and a fish is a kind of animal, then a trout is a kind of animal. But they do not infer that if a car seat is a kind of chair and a chair is a kind of furniture, then a car seat is a kind of furniture. Special intuitions about living things begin early in life. Recall that the human infant is far from being a bag of reflexes, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. 3 to 6 month infants, well before they can move about or even see very well, know about objects and their possible motions, how they causally impinge on one another, their properties like compressibility, and their number and how it changes with addition and subtraction. The distinction between living and non-living things is appreciated early, perhaps before the first birthday. The cut initially takes the form of a difference between inanimate objects that move around according to the laws of billiard ball physics and objects like people and animals that are self-propelled. For example, in an experiment by the psychologist Elizabeth Spelke, a baby is shown a ball rolling behind a screen and another ball emerging from the other side, over and over again, to the point of boredom. If the screen is removed and the infant sees the expected hidden event, one ball hitting the other and launching it on its way, the baby's interest is only momentarily revived. Presumably, this is what the baby had been imagining all along. But if the screen is removed and the baby sees the magical event of one object stopping dead in its tracks without reaching the second ball, and the second ball taking off mysteriously on its own, the baby stares for much longer. Crucially, infants expect inanimate balls and animate people to move according to different laws. In another scenario, people, not balls, disappeared and appear from behind the screen. After the screen was removed, the infants showed little surprise when they saw one person stop short and the other up and move. They were more surprised by a collision. By the time children are of nursery school and kindergarten age, they display a subtle understanding that living things fall into kinds with hidden essences. The psychologist Frank Keel has challenged children with pixelated questions like these. Doctors took a raccoon, shows picture of a raccoon, and shaved away some of its fur. They died what